Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. This week is, okay, maybe my favorite person in the whole world, Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Welcome back, Blair.
Well, I guess that puts me ahead of Murray. Is that possible?
Ahead of Murray and certainly ahead of David Christina, our producer. So I guess there are a lot of things to talk about. The New York State primaries are now over. What did we learn?
Well, it was clear that the governor put all of his, all of his chits on the table. He used, government resources to the maximum extent possible. He spent tons of money. He had a message that resonated with Democratic primary voters, and he did reasonably well. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. He played the hand he was dealt very well and won a resounding victory. Now, after that, it gets a little more complicated. I mean, it certainly the lieutenant governor's race was very close. The incumbent, Kathy Hochul, edged out New York City Council member Jumaane Williams. The race for attorney general turned out to be Letitia James, who's the New York City public advocate. So she was elected to citywide office, but she won with basically under 40% of the vote because of splits between Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney and Zephyr Teachout. And then at the state Senate, which was really a lot of ways where the action was, of the eight so-called independent Democratic Conference members, six of them lost. And I think the big news was huge turnout relative to what you normally have in a Democratic primary. And if anything, that shows, I think, that the Democratic base is active and turned on. I think that could spell some trouble for Republicans in November.
That's a great summary, Blair Horner. So what are we going to do for the rest of the show? Okay, so
talk about Murray.
Murray the dog. Okay, so let's move on and see if we can parse each of those. This is a town, Albany, where conspiracy theory reigns supreme.
Yes.
And there is a particular conspiracy theory that is floating around, which, I tend to think is probably nonsense, but I wondered what you thought. And that is that Sean Patrick Maloney actually came into the race so that the vote would be split so that Zephyr Teachout could not win for attorney general. Do you think it's balderdash?
Well, it's always hard to know exactly what's going on in someone else's head, but I can tell you
if you
put Teachout and Maloney's numbers together, they get over 50% of the vote. And if you look at how it's split across the state, I mean, James won eight downstate counties out of the 62.
Tish James.
Yes, Letitia James is the winner. And all of those were downstate. Teachout took Manhattan and basically split up state with Maloney. So had only one of those two run, they probably would be the nominee right now.
Well, to me, the issue in that particular race was somebody who could keep their eye on the governor. I mean, I say that fairly because, after all, he has been surrounded by a certain amount of muck and corruption. Some of his best people are on their way to the hoosegow. So you would think you'd want an attorney general who could stay separate. Now, Letitia James made it clear, as she saw the way the cards were unfolding, that she would be tough on Cuomo, except that she was Cuomo's person.
Yeah, I mean, the governor pushed for Letitia James to be the nominee. He got her. She was originally elected to the city council as the Working Families Party nominee and beat the Democrats.
Which is so interesting about her.
Yeah.
It may, in fact, I'm sorry to say this, go to character, because the Working Families Party gave her her start in politics.
That's exactly right.
And then she turned around and hit them over the head with an iron pipe. You want to tell us about that?
Well, the governor apparently leaned on her not to take the Working Families Party line. And so she did not when the convention was held in May. And so that the price of that apparently was the governor's support, and it worked out for her. The Working Families Party did not really have a real designee for attorney general. They sort of left the seat open. They appointed someone as a caretaker to see what would happen with the Teachout James, because Zephyr Teachout is another hero of the Working Families Party. And so my assumption is that they will end up endorsing Letitia James. She'll accept it now. And, you know, what? How she behaves as Attorney General is an interesting question. Certainly, she will be, as a newly elected Attorney General, assuming she wins in November, it would be hard for her to be enormously independent of a governor who, if he wins, will be at the peak of his political power.
Which is why I suspect when it comes to prosecuting statewide crimes, we see, for example, Shelley Silver on his way to jail now. When it comes to prosecuting those, it's almost always the feds, not the state attorney general, who does that.
Well, I mean, under New York state law, it's hard for the state attorney general to get involved. I mean, there is some capacity to do that. But generally speaking, the attorney general has to wait for a referral from a particular state agency in order to prosecute. They do have some authority, but it's limited. So, for example, when the former attorney general went after a state senator out in Niagara County, it was off, as I recall, off a referral from the Election Law Council. And so the powers of the attorney general to really go after corruption is somewhat limited.
We're talking to the remarkable Blair Horner of New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair, I want to take you back to the days when there was something in this state called the Moreland Act Commission, which had been established by none other than the present governor, and said he was going to root out corruption. And then something happened. What happened?
Well, just so everybody knows, under New York state law, there's something called the Moreland Act. It gives the governor authority to create a commission to look into improper activities in the executive branch and in state government. This governor, for example, had created a Moreland Commission to look into the ramifications of the Superstorm Sandy impact on Long Island and why they didn't have power. So it's not just about corruption, but you're right. He created one to look into corruption. He pledged that it would be to operate independently and without fear or favor. He worked with the attorney general to deputize the members of the Moreland Commission to be deputized attorneys general. And they were going to go after corruption. They issued their first report, and then as part of a backroom deal on the budget, the governor pulled the plug on the Moreland Commission at the behest of the now discredited former Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos and former Speaker of the Assembly Shelley Silver.
But some people thought that it was not only at their behest, but that maybe the Moreland Act Commission was getting a little too close to where Cuomo lived.
There are certainly media reports to that effect that the governor's office was not happy with them looking at the executive branch. You know, again, since we don't know exactly how all of these deals work out, it's classic Albany, everything's done behind closed doors. What the motivations were for everybody is clearer now with Skelos and Silver having been convicted of corruption and facing time in the pokey. The governor's motivations is less clear, but he did do it. He jettisoned it as part of a deal. And as a result, we'll never know what the Moreland Commission would have found. Although a lot of their files were seized by former U.S. Attorney Preparara and may have provided more evidence for the investigations that he had.
Who's Elaine Calieros?
Elaine Calieros is the former poobah of the state's nanotechnology strategies, economic development activities. He was the engine behind the creation of the Nano Center in Albany under Governor Pataki and was used by this governor really to develop a Erie Canal 21st century investment high-tech corridor that would go from Albany to Buffalo. And in that capacity, has now also been convicted of corruption for gaming the state's procurement process to favored builders out in Buffalo, around the Buffalo Billion, who happened to be big campaign contributors to the governor.
Another case, right, in which the feds have to do the convicting. This guy was considered to be too big, too hot to touch. Worked for several governors, and people thought that he was really, you know, so important to the state's economic development that he couldn't be touched, but he was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the issue of gaming the procurement process got the attention of the feds. There was a unique investigative journalistic operation in Buffalo called the Investigative Post, which had been digging into this issue and found a lot of things that I think provided the impetus for the U.S. Attorney's Office to look at it. It's not clear to me exactly what Calieros got out of the deal, other than he was getting things done on time, at least as he viewed it.
And got the governor's favor.
And the governor's favor. unlike other corruption scandals where a close aide to the governor, Joseph Prococo, was convicted of corruption because he was feathering his own nest while he was raising campaign contributions, in this case, Calieros was gaming the system to benefit particular companies.
And these companies, correct me if I'm wrong, sometimes contributors to the Cuomo campaign.
Yeah, they're big contributors. But it's, you know, again, it's not entirely clear what Calieros was getting out of it other than brownie points. Nevertheless, he's now facing time in the pokey as well. He was just convicted just recently.
Well, we're talking pokey. As you mentioned before, Sheldon Silver, on this radio show many times, is on his way to prison, and he done it. I mean, he clearly was convicted by a jury of...
Twice
of gaming the system in such a way as, I'll do this for you, if you'll do this for me. He's going to prison. You know, I've never understood Blair Horner of Nyberg, why it is that these guys are so stupid that they risk everything.
Yeah, you know, I think they might develop like a blind spot over time that they just think they're smarter than everybody else. They figured out the system. They cut one corner, they get away with it. So they keep cutting away at the corners and they end up with no envelope. And, you know, in this particular case, if it wasn't for Bharara.
I like that so much, I'm going to use it. Cutting away at so many corners that in the end there was no envelope. You're terrific, Blair. Right?
But, you know, had Bharara not been on the scene, he might have got away with it. Because sure. It was all Bharara, and same thing with former Senate Majority Leader Dane Skelos. If it wasn't for Bharara, we would never have found out how they were using their public office for private gain, and that's a no-no.
Let's talk about one of my favorite characters in state government, Larry Schwartz. I worked with Larry Schwartz years and years ago when I worked for Senator Ornstein, and now there's the story of the other side of the paper, and which I think is going down in the annals of the great tales of New York State. Want to go into that one?
Yeah, I mean, it's been reported that there was a flyer that went out the week before the election, essentially attacking Cynthia Nixon for being anti-Semitic, and it sort of blew up in their face. The staff person, or the campaign volunteer, in the case of Larry Schwartz, who was responsible for reviewing the document before it went out, is Larry Schwartz, a former top aide to the governor, former secretary to the governor Cuomo and to Governor Patterson. He approved the flyer, but says it was on the backside of the flyer and he didn't turn it over.
You mean the scurrilous remark about her being an anti-Semite despite the fact that she goes to synagogue every week and is raising her kids Jewish.
All of those things.
Yes.
Sort of one of those miracle things. Apparently his defense is he didn't turn over the flyer to see what was on the backside.
I didn't turn over the flyer. As I say, going down in New York State history. So Tom DiNapoli's got a race, as he often does, for state controller coming up. DiNapoli's never really been a favorite of this governor.
Nope.
You know, sometimes the governor, you know, takes him on. Sometimes he looks the other way. I wonder what you think it can make of that race.
Well, I mean, New York is an overwhelmingly Democratic enrollment advantage state, and I think the Republicans are going to have a hard time this November, given the Trump brand. You see it with the governor reacting to his opponent, Molinaro, calling him a mini Trump all the time. I mean, they're going to just stick that label on them. And in New York, I mean, basically half the enrolled population is Democrat and the other half is split more or less between Republicans and everybody else. So I think the Republicans will have a hard time. No one has really been able to come up with a cogent argument as to why DiNapoli deserves to lose. He ran for re-election and won last time. And anytime you're trying to persuade voters to kick out an incumbent, you got to make a case as to why the way they voted last time is not the way they should vote this time. And I haven't heard that yet. But the race is really just heating up. The primaries play out. Everybody on the Republican side, I think, was waiting for the smoke to clear. And so we'll see what the Republicans can come up with.
Another big story, of course, was the rout of the so-called Independent Democratic Conference. Quite a rout. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a lot of these things are often turn on what's happening in a particular district. So one of the big federal primaries, congressional primaries that played out was the defeat of, you know, political heavyweight Joe Crowley by this insurgent. And who framed herself as a Democratic Socialist.
But the governor has termed that a fluke.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was less about ideology and more about a combination of changing demographics within his district.
Absolutely.
Crowley's district went from overwhelmingly white to basically half Latino. And the winner of the primary is Latina. And also the increasing gentrification of parts of New York City, I think, allow people younger people are getting more engaged in what they see in the process, and they're not afraid of the socialist label. So I saw that also in some of the Democratic races. So where current State Senator Martin DeLon lost in a primary, that district is incredibly gentrified. It's really changed a lot since he became a state senator. And I think a lot of that stuff, when you have younger, single, typically more affluent voters getting engaged for the first time, and his opponent Salazar framed herself as a Democratic Socialist, I think that that gentrification it really came out to hurt him.
Well, you know, that's so interesting that you say that, because here was this group, and they were clearly making out like bandits by being friends of the Republicans and keeping them in power, this independent
Democratic. Although DeLon
government.
Was not an IDC member.
Uh-huh.
He was a moderate Democrat.
Yeah.
I mean, but the Avella loses to Lou in a rematch last time around. Avella barely squeaked by to beat Lou in terms of the IDC. Klein loses to Biagi, and that district has some gentrification going on, but it was really about what Klein had been really sort of the face of the Independent Democratic Conference.
The leader.
The leader. And so there's things happening in his district.
But the chutzpah factor of the Democrats who get themselves elected and then go over to the other side and keep the Republicans in power. And it took a long time for that sort of reputation to catch up with them. Now, the governor played a role in that, didn't he?
Well, it widely reported that the governor was involved in the IDC's activities in terms of their coalition government with the Senate Republicans. When he wanted them to stop being in coalition, they'd stopped. That being said, I mean, I think a lot of these things happen. There's other issues, but what ties it all together is the anti-Trump view of New Yorkers, particularly Democrats, are fired up. And these individuals, by and large, were tied to the Republican Party. And that's a very damaged brand in New York, certainly among Democrats. And that it was a huge, again, about a quarter of the Democrats showed up at the polls. So it's not like a huge turnout in that terms. But compared to normal turnouts, it was a huge turnout. And I think it's because the base is fired up. And I think the members of the IDC paid a price for that, for their allegiance or alliance with the Republicans in the state Senate.
As I have said many times, even though I shouldn't, they deserved everything they got. Okay, so that leaves us now with Chris Collins. Now, Chris Collins, a congressman from the Niagara region, and he gets indicted. And he has now said, okay, I am not going to get off the ballot. I'm going to run for office, and he may very well win.
That's right. That's
right.
He was one of the first members of Congress to endorse President Trump.
So he'll now, let's assume he wins. And there's a Democrat who many people consider to be okay, but not the top of the heap. In terms of desirable candidates to run against them. You're making a face. Am I wrong in interpreting your facial
expression? it's the face. This is why I'm on radio, Alan. I have a face for radio.
You do. No, you don't. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to. I mean, the Collins seat is a safe Republican seat. It's hard for Democrats to mount a challenge and win. You're right. Collins is going to run even though he's been indicted. Basically using his public office for private gain. It was sort of a little more indirect in the sense that he was tipping people off. I think his son was one of them, that a particular stock was going to tank that they had investments in. And so they were able to sort of save themselves.
Insider trading.
That's right. But he doesn't have to leave office unless he's convicted. He's
sure.
Only been indicted. He's innocent until proven guilty. It's a safe Republican district. It's entirely possible he'll still win.
Yeah. I suppose we have to go to one other congressional race that I've been looking at lately, and that's Tinney versus Brindisi in the Utica Binghamton.
Right. What a weird district, right?
Quite a district. And according to some of the polling now, Brindisi, the assemblyman, is leading Tenney, the incumbent Republican congresswoman. What do you make of that one?
Yeah, I mean, the Tenney seat, the Faso seat, those are the kinds of seats the Democrats really are going to have to take if they think they're going to be able to take the House.
Flip the House.
And the predecessor to Tenney in that congressional district was a Republican, but he was viewed widely as a moderate Republican. And so the district itself is not as inherently conservative as you might find in other parts of the state. Brindisi is a very successful member of the assembly. Tenney was also a long time had been reelected a number of times, a member of the assembly. And so it's a real contest, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Now, what about Faso versus Delgado? Now, Delgado, of course, is a man of color. He was once a rapper. On the other hand, he is a brilliant, brilliant man. He's gone to the top institutions in the country. Some people think that Faso has been running a racist campaign.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know how I'm not as close to the action. Just for everybody knows, Nyberg is nonpartisan.
Of
we don't wear a
not.
Particular jersey.
No.
The interesting thing is, there's an independent in that race, and how she impacts the turnout for either Delgado or Faso, I think, may well be the difference as to who wins. It's not entirely clear to me where her base would come from, her vote would come from. May be geographic, it may be ideological, and it may be the difference maker in terms of whether or not Faso is able to hold on to the seat or loses it.
Down in the Hudson Valley, you have Sean Patrick Maloney, who has run both for attorney general and lost, as we've discussed, then is also going back to run for Congress again. Is there a danger that the people in that district may find him to have been less than honorable in running for both and potentially coming
well,
back?
It's certainly possible. I mean, if I'm a Republican candidate against somebody like that, I would definitely be using it as a cudgel against them. How the voters view about him personally and how they view the fact that he ran for attorney general is, I guess, less clear to me how that will impact. I mean, clearly it'll be an argument that a Republican will make. And in some of those counties, in either in his district or near his district, Zephyr Teachout won those counties. And so, in New York, it's difficult, if not impossible. Obviously, it's not impossible. It's difficult to run for two offices at the same time. And so I can't even think of another example of where it's happened. So we'll see. I mean, you know, again, the...
Lyndon Johnson ran both for president.
Not in New York.
Exactly right. In Texas, he ran for both president and, for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah. Connolly did too, I think.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, again, it's not unheard of. I mean, I had always believed that in New York, under New York state law, you couldn't run for two offices at the same time.
Well,
it
turns out that his argument was that since he was the sitting congressman, and he didn't have to make up his mind, he could run for attorney general. If he won that, he would resign his seat. But, of course, that might endanger the seat.
Yes.
And I'm thinking if the Democrats lose the ability to flip by one vote, somebody's going to get a certain amount of lightning thrown their way.
That's right. We'll see. I mean, again, there's the nationalization of all of these congressional races. It's hard to tell exactly how that's going to play out. But I assume that Maloney, who was, as far as I could tell, in reasonably good shape going into the election cycle, has handed his opponent a weapon. Whether or not it's a weapon that causes serious harm or not, I think, is unclear.
Always great to talk to our friend, a man I very much admire, Blair Hornady, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Blair, thanks for doing this program. I always learn so much from you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.